This special Coast Community Radio public affairs program was recorded live at a town hall meeting with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley at the Bob Chisholm Community Center in Seaside, Oregon, on February 20th, 2018. About 100 people filled the center for the event. Following his opening remarks, the senator took questions from the crowd.
Good afternoon. My name is Tita Montero. I'm the council president for the city of Seaside. Welcome, everyone, to a town hall meeting with Senator Merkley. It's my pleasure to be able to introduce Senator Merkley today. During his service as a state representative and as our Oregon senator, Jeff Merkley has emphasized fighting for the success of Oregon's working families. That means fighting for good-paying jobs, strong public schools, and affordable college and health care. Jeff is a native Oregonian and a son of a millwright. He was born in Myrtle Creek, Oregon, and his family moved with the timber economy to Roseburg and then to East Multnomah County. He was elected to the Oregon House of Representatives in 1998. In 2007, he became Speaker of the Oregon House and held that post until his election to the U.S. Senate. He began his involvement in policy as an intern for Oregon Senator Mark Hatfield, and in 2009, he was sworn into the same Senate seat once held by Mark Hatfield. Jeff holds an open town hall in every Oregon county every year. This is his 10th town hall this year and his 334th overall town hall. We're happy to have him here in Seaside today. Please welcome Oregon's U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley.
Well, Tita, thank you very much for emceeing today, and thank you all for coming out today and filling this hall. It's and there are a couple more seats if anyone wants to have one. Come on in. We've got some on this side. We're here at the community center, and I wanted to thank the Sunset Empire Park and Recreation for hosting us and setting everything up wherever you are, Darren and team. Thank you. Well done. And I wanted to alert you all, and you mentioned in the introduction that I had an intern with Senator Hatfield. We have internships at my various state offices and also in Washington, D.C. So if you know anyone who's really interested in policy or governance and it would like to be an intern, please let them know that that exists. I don't know who told me that there was such a thing as congressional internships, but somebody must have mentioned it to me, and I applied to Senator Hatfield, and it was an incredible, incredible education. And we do have unfortunately, most internships are unfunded, but we do have a funded internship for someone who would never otherwise be able to come to D.C. and participate. And then at each town hall, I like to shine a light on a local organization that's doing something very positive in the community. And today we're going to shine that light on the Harbor Northwest. And Molly Pringle, I think, is here. Molly? Okay, great. Welcome, Molly. So the Harbor Northwest has been providing intervention, recovery, and support to the survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking for over 40 years. And they serve, if I have this right, this number sounded high to me, but about in a single year, about 5% of the population in some form is served in the county, which is extraordinary. And their programs include peer support, emergency referrals, other advocacy-based programs to foster safety, security, and freedom of the Clatsop County women. And so would you like to share a word or two about what you're doing? And if you have any upcoming events or fundraisers or need help from the community, this is a chance to share that.
Sure. Thank you so much, and thank you all for being here. Like Senator Merkley said, the harbor is Clatsop County's one of our primary resources for survivors of domestic and sexual violence, and we're here for all survivors and friends and family who care about survivors. So we have a 24-hour crisis line. Any of you can reach out to us at any time, and we are here for you. And I wanted to say thank you to Senator Merkley, because I know that he does not tolerate sexual violence in his community at the Capitol. And I think that that's one of the most important things that we can do here together, is to not tolerate violence and to believe and support survivors. And if y'all want to learn more, definitely, we're revamping our website right now, but reach out to us. We're always seeking volunteers, and that doesn't have to mean providing advocacy directly to survivors. We always need support in terms of community engagement, doing outreach and events coordination and things like that. So there are ways to help and speak out and support survivors. I know many of you do that, and we couldn't do our work without your support. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Molly. And hold on a sec. And just as a way of symbolically recognizing that this is a flag for your organization that has been flown over the U.S. Capitol, and we have a box and certificate and so forth, but just wanted to use that to say symbolically, huge thank you for the work you all are doing.
Thank you.
So, quite a lot going on in our country. Where do I start? I'll tell you, I went over to the Munich Security Conference, and what I was concerned most about right now in terms of the possibility of war is North Korea. And even though that seems far away from here, to hear one of the participants stand up and say, "Don't worry about North Korea. The president has his fingers, at his fingertips is available a force that can quickly resolve the problem." And I just want to say, I'm sponsoring a bill that is a bill that says to the president, remember the Constitution gives warfighting powers to the Congress, and that there should be no first use of nuclear weapons. We have several foundations for families to thrive in a community, and one is healthcare, one is education, one is housing, and one is good paying jobs. And I'd like to see our national budget focus on those four pillars for American families to thrive. And what bothers me is we just had a tax bill pass that spent $1.5 trillion. And that $1.5 trillion essentially was redistributed to the most affluent in America. There's a little bit of help for the middle class, but the same bill pulls the plug on the insurance pool, and the estimate from Congressional Budget Office is that will increase the cost of health care premiums by 10% next year. So for most of the middle class, whatever help, little bit of help you might get on the tax side is going to be offset by higher insurance premiums. And meanwhile, that's a whole lot of resources. It isn't available to develop infrastructure, et cetera. And what did we see in the budget that the president just delivered? He delivered this last week. Now, this is the budget for FY19, fiscal year 19, starts in October. And the budget has in it a $500 billion cut to Medicare. Anybody care about Medicare being funded when you? It has a $500 billion cut to other health care, and then a whole series of other things besides. So essentially you have the $1.5 trillion handed out in the tax bill, and then over $1 trillion taken away from fundamental programs in this budget. I'll be immersed in the spending committee, the appropriations committee, to try to protect the foundations for families and communities to thrive, and that means rejecting a whole lot of what is in the budget that was just delivered. And I think we'll have bipartisan support to do a lot of that work. We have some good news in that we got significant budget authority to help take on the opioid crisis, and that's an important piece. That's budget authority, but now we have to actually get it into the spending bill. And that spending bill, over the next couple weeks, I'll be immersed in. Hopefully within the next month, we'll have that piece nailed down. Obviously, we have issues here on the coast. You may say, well, how did the coast fare in the president's budget? Well, the National Ocean Atmospheric Administration has $1 billion cut out of it, and a quarter of that billion are specifically coastal programs. And so that, again, is a place where the president's budget is not the blueprint that we want to follow. And we're pushing on the administration to be helpful with the various fishing disasters that we've had and the programs that support tsunami warning and earthquake warning and measures to strengthen infrastructure or relocate critical infrastructure. And by the way, when it comes to Interior Secretary Zinke's plan to drill off the Oregon coast, let's just say no, absolutely not off the coast of Oregon. So I want to go to your questions and comments, and if you could, we're going to do it by calling numbers so that we're going to get a basket in your hand just shortly. Here it comes. And we'll read the last three numbers and just wave your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. If somebody's speaking and you passionately disagree with them, please be very respectful. Let them have their say, and we'll ask everyone else to return the courtesy when it's your turn to speak and share a thought. And so with that, let's just turn right to the numbers. And we'll read several of them, so we'll have people on deck. And here we go.
211 and 241.
Right back here is one of our ticket holders in the blue. You had a ticket? One of those? Yeah. And any of those other three? Right here? Right here. Okay. We'll come to you next. We'll come right to you after this gentleman. Okay. We'll come right to you next. Okay.
Thank you. So I had several questions, but one of the central questions involves infrastructure. My understanding of the current proposal for this $1 trillion infrastructure is that the feds are only going to come up with $200 billion, and the other $800 billion are going to be put on the backs of state and local authorities. And I just want to be clear that as a city representative, we don't have resources. We don't have resources to, you know, we're just barely keeping up with what we have and taking small bites into our infrastructure. And to expect to get some small pittance from the federal government and having to come up with a major portion of it just doesn't work. We just can't do it. So it seems to be a know-nothing bill. And I think that I would like to hear you talk about that a little bit. And sort of in conjunction with, I do have a small issue with defense spending, because it's such a, something needs, you would think that we have intelligent people to really rethink what's important for security. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And let's start with the infrastructure side. So we anticipated last year in 2017 that the first thing we'd hear about was a plan for infrastructure, bipartisan support. We have vastly underfunded infrastructure, everything from the transportation system to rural broadband to our jetties and our ports. And we didn't get a proposal last year. We finally did now here in year two. And the proposal is essentially a couple things. One is we'll put in a little bit of money, and then whatever the states and counties do, we'll take credit for it, and that'll be part of our $1.5 trillion infrastructure. Everyone who has billions of dollars to spend, you'll get a little bit of tiny assistance, but you've got to first have that billion dollar. And the second was to turn to Wall Street to have private companies essentially do so-called public-private partnerships in which the infrastructure is owned by the company, and then they have put tolls on us for from here to eternity for what they own. And you can't do a lot of infrastructure in that fashion. How are you going to toll for a jetty or et cetera? I mean, lots of complexity there. But the second is, I don't want to sell off our public infrastructure. We get a lot more infrastructure when we do direct investment. We pay for it up front, and we own it, and we don't get taxed for 100 years on the back end. So there's a lot of problems with that infrastructure bill. And the defense spending, the budget authority that was just passed did a massive increase in defense spending. I was fascinated to see, oh, we need another $57 billion in defense spending, and by the time the bill was completed, it was up to $88 billion for 2 years, so over $150 billion on top of, and we do spend more than the next dozen countries combined. And I must say, just to give you one example, we should not still be in Afghanistan. Afghanistan should be over, we should be done, we shouldn't be spending $45 billion a year there. And we are, as a first world developed country, completely underinvesting in our healthcare system, our basic public infrastructure, and our education. And we're falling behind the rest of the world, and we are just digging ourselves into a pit, and we have got to change that. I think we were here next.
So many things, but last time I talked with Senator Wyden about healthcare, he said that he had been working on a project to develop a system of healthcare between Washington, Oregon, and California. It seems to me that the dysfunction in Washington and the way things are going, we're never going to get to single payer that way, but we might get to it by having Oregon do their own, which we're trying to do, and Washington, California joining us, bigger pool, lower cost, so forth. What can you say about that? What do you know about that? Talk about that.
So the basic point, and Senator Wyden has been looking, California in particular has been working on a single payer, and could we partner with them? A lot of, they've been having a legislative battle on it this year in California. Not clear where that's going to come out yet. But the idea is, as you described it, let's take a region of the country and try to do what the entire country doesn't seem to be able to do. Now, let me tell you, the complexity of our healthcare system is enormous. Big surprise, right? I mean, if you're hurt at work, it's workers' compensation. If you have a job that covers your healthcare, great, and then the next year the employer says, but not your children, so now how do you get your children onto the children's health insurance program? And then maybe your job doesn't pay as much, and you're eligible for the Oregon health plan, but you get paid a little more, and you got to buy insurance on the exchange. How do you do that? I mean, it's just all these different systems and ways and applications, and it's enormous stress. It's enormous stress. How about just a simple, seamless Medicare for all by virtue of living here in the United States of America? And I don't have any more details than what he shared with you. It's a very early stage of pondering conceptually.
Okay, this is a total left turn from that, and it's about guns. I've been driving since I was 16 and had a car since I was 18, and I have paid liability, and I've never been in an accident other than with my dad's mailbox in 55 years.
How dare that mailbox attack you?
It was icy. It was icy, and I took the corner too fast. But the thing is, I pay liability because there are people out there who are irresponsible with their cars. Why do not people who own massively dangerous guns have to pay liability insurance so that when something horrible happens, if they're not going to give up their rights, then they can damn well pay for them?
So I hadn't heard about that particular approach, but let me get a little feedback on some of the pieces that are being discussed nationally. One is to not allow the sale of kits that modify a semi-automatic into an automatic bump stock. How many people like that idea? How many people would oppose that idea? Second concept is not selling semi-automatic assault rifles to minors. Okay, we'll go to that. Let's start with minors, not selling them to minors. How many would support that? How many would oppose that? How about not having assault rifles at all? Yeah. Support. Opposition. Okay. How about magazine size? Getting rid of the large magazines. Opposition. Okay. Well, I got a text from a friend saying, "Are we going to see Congress act?" And I wrote back and said, "Very unlikely." Because it's essentially paralyzed by the influence of the gun manufacturers and the massive amounts of money that they're spending. I fully support the Second Amendment, but I don't think that means that we want guns in the hands of those who have committed felonies, have committed domestic violence assaults, or those who are unstable. Mentally unstable, and there need to be some reasonable boundaries in that, and that means background check system needs to be significantly improved. Now, Oregon has done a lot on the background check system, but in terms of we have closed the gun show loophole and the Craigslist loophole, how many folks support doing that nationally? Background opposed? Okay, well that's helpful feedback, and thank you. I'm not expecting we'll see a bill on the floor of the Senate. I tell you, we should wrestle with this country. We've had 30, since January 1st, we've had 30 mass shootings in the United States. It's not quite one a day, but it's pretty close to that. So, yes, and the children in Florida made quite a statement. Okay, thank you. Any of the above. Right over here.
So you're going to be able to answer this very easily, but what are we going to do in this country with the EPA being destroyed and this country being destroyed by Scott Pruitt? Please help us.
It really shows how much an administrator can do in being inside of an agency and dismantling it. And we're seeing that with Scott Pruitt, as you indicated, and the EPA undoing. He has made 20 changes to regulations involving clean air. And he came to our committee and testified how much he was in favor of clean air. So I asked him, I said, well, of the 20 changes you've made, how many have been ones that improved the air rather than decreased the quality of the air? He says, well, I don't know. I said, well, zero. Every single one lowered the standard for air. And I said, and you know, an example of that, how many of your changes, of your 20 changes were supported by the American Lung Association, which cares about clean air? He says, well, I have no idea. I said, well, maybe you should talk to them, because the answer is zero. And so on and so forth. But there's so much that he's doing from the inside. And also you see it with Mick Mulvaney and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This bureau was all about a fair, square deal in financial transactions so that they help build the wealth of Americans, not be predatory tricks and traps designed to cheat people. And he's undoing everything he possibly can, including delaying the payday loan provisions. And here in Oregon, we banned. I was speaker, and I led this drive to ban these 500% interest loans. Every civilization on the face of the earth has looked at high interest loans and said those destroy the foundations of a society. You know, our military went to Congress and said, our military men and women are being deeply damaged by these payday loans. Please ban them for military families. Amen. But let's ban them for everybody else, too, because we care about all the families here in the United States of America. And you asked, how am I going to change that? That's called a 2020 election with somebody different being appointed to the to drive the agency. I just wouldn't know how to act in first class. Do we have anybody else in that group of tickets? Yes, sir.
I have
212. 212? Is that one of our tickets?
That is one of the tickets.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Paul Ryan and his group would like to do away with Social Security. And, of course, they are now talking about giving people who are on welfare box lunches and stuff like that. What can the Senate do to stop that kind of action?
Well, hopefully quite a bit. Paul Ryan announced a week before the tax bill was passed that his second plan was to take and rebalance the deficit that he was creating by the tax bill by diminishing Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. And I went, didn't surprise me he said it. It surprised me he said it before the vote on the tax bill. Like, I'm about to give $1 trillion to the richest Americans, and oh, by the way, I want to take it away from old folks and people who need health care. Are you crazy? How can a bill like that pass in a democratic republic? How can, I mean, really, it's insane. But it shows that we have a fundamental problem, a fundamental battle in America between the vision of our Constitution, we, the people, set up to make sure that the decisions of government were, as Lincoln put it, of, by, and for the people, and government by and for the powerful. And they don't need Medicare, they don't need Social Security, they don't need Medicaid, so why not shrink those and give themselves more tax benefits? And that's exactly the vision that Paul Ryan has put out. Now, my feeling is that if our founders wanted a government by and for the powerful, they could have copied Europe, but they said we want to do it differently. And they made the first three words of the Constitution about that mission statement. And Jefferson said the only way we'll get government that reflects the will of the people is to have the power distributed among the people, which is the opposite of Citizens United. Citizens United Court, have you heard of Citizens United Court decision? Yes? 5-4 decision that says that billionaires, massively wealthy, can give unlimited sums in elections. That is not a distribution of power among the people. That's a concentration that produces government by and for the privileged. Well, how about we reclaim our country and the vision it was founded on, the We the People vision it was founded on? Okay, 224. Is that one of our numbers? Yeah, right here.
First, I want to thank you for coming to Seaside and putting up with Trump in the White House. I think I really do. I thank you very much. And my question is, are we, the Democrats, grooming someone to be our president of the United States? Are you thinking about it?
You know, obviously our town halls are bipartisan town halls, are not about one party or another, but there is a yin and yang in American politics.
Okay.
I'm hoping that if Trump is the yin, that there'll be a whole lot of yang coming. I'll put it that way. And I do feel like there's an enormous organizing energy around the country saying we're way off track right now. Yeah. And I can tell you that what is I'm immersed in on the political side is the vision of 2018, because I really want to see a majority in the House or Senate to stop bad policy and to stop the packing of the courts.
Yeah. My second question,
only get one.
You know what? I'm 80 years old, and I can say what I want or do what I want. I'm a senior citizen.
Yeah. I think we have a special provision for
that's
people.
That's right. Are they going after the NRA, the National Rifleman Association? Are they, inspecting them or, you know, we know where the lot of money goes to Trump and to the Republicans, but.
No, I don't. I think the answer is no. If you mean if they mean the government, is the government going after the NRA? No, they're an independent organization. They
yes.
They advocate as they like, and some of the things they advocate for. I grew up with the gun safety and so on and so forth. And but then they get into areas where I think they've gone too far, and I think we need right. to have that dialogue in America.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Don't you get a third question when you're over 80? One is right up here. By the way, I wanted to introduce Stacy Jochimson, and Stacy's over here. And so Stacy is my field rep. And anything we don't get to today that you want to follow up with my team, you can just get one of her cards, and she can get you in contact with the right member of the team. And I also wanted to introduce Joel, who is dressed in a gray beard over here. When did that beard turn gray anyway, Joel?
About 6 months ago.
So he is head of my constituent services team. And so if you're dealing with some red tape for your veterans benefits, for disability, for visas, for a family member who's locked in a prison overseas, I mean, a whole host of things, call, and we'll find, or you can also talk to Joel while you're here, and we'll have the right member of the team follow up with you. So just want to introduce him. Yes, sir.
Senator, as I spoke to you earlier, I'm a veteran. I'm a veteran, as I'm sure some of you are, and I would like those who were veterans to raise their hands.
And let's show some appreciation for our veterans.
Now, three things. We do not need a parade. Second, the veterans should be better taken care of. Talk is cheap. Talk is real cheap. We need to take care of them. And the third thing is, I was in medicine for 42 years, 24 in the military and 3 with the VA. I didn't serve in a combat zone, but I took care of the guys who did serve in combat zones. And I know what it looks like when somebody gets hit with an automatic weapon, and it's ugly. We have to do something.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, our soldiers have stood up for us in so many conflicts around the world, and we have to stand up for them. And the Veterans Administration has been way behind in providing help. One of the challenges is we have a lot of doctors and nurses retiring, and we have a lot of older Americans, those baby boomers who are needing more medical care. And so we have this imbalance, and it's making it hard on every medical group, including the VA. One of the things I sponsored was a docs to doctors bill so that those who had provided medical care within the military structure had a path that encouraged them to come back home and be part of the Veterans Administration to provide medical care ongoing with our military members. But we have a lot of work to do, and thank you. Anyone else in that group? Yes. 227? Oh, sorry.
We'll be back there in just a second.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator, for being here. Here to taking care of our vets. I watched the politicos on Sunday, track a lot of the news during the week, and it's frustrating to not see policy coming from Democrats or more Democrats speaking out, and I compliment you on what you have done to speak out against for policy and against Trump's policies. But I'm wondering why we don't have a parade of Democrats outraged and speaking every week on these ridiculous policies that are coming out of the White House and the Republicans in Congress. So please do more.
You know, sometimes I feel like all we're doing is ranting about all the things that are going wrong. And that's why I feel it's so important to talk about what would really make our country work better. And that's when I'm talking about the four corners of the foundation for families, healthcare, education, living wage, job, and a decent house. It's like, let's be outraged, and we're outraged on a daily basis, but let's also lay out a vision of how much more we could do in our country with the resources we have for a chance and an opportunity for every person to thrive or have the opportunity to thrive. Okay. The almost 80 exception. Well, so this is a very frustrating question to me that you're speaking out. There is a whole detailed policy piece that we put together this last year called Better Deal, and nobody cares. Nobody wants to read something that detailed at this point. So the press doesn't talk about it. Nobody's aware of it, but you can look it up, the Better Deal. And just like we put out a detailed infrastructure plan on how to actually do $1 trillion of direct investment in America. But the bully pulpit is always with the executive branch. And right now it seems like even no matter how much effort there is to talk about the details of how you do good work to make the systems work better, it's drowned out by the daily tweets and outrage and so on and so forth. So keep look. There is a fair amount of work that's being done, and hopefully we'll... In the course of campaigns this coming year, there'll be a lot more substantive talk. Thanks.
Thanks for coming, Jeff. My question is about the immigration situation. I know the Dreamers have kind of been put on the back burner of late, and it seems like in order for them to get the rights that they deserve, we're going to have to build a wall along the Mexican border and pay for that very expensive wall. And I was wondering if anything is being done with respect to the Dreamers. You know, Oregon and Clatsop County have a quite significant number of immigrants that have lived here now and have lived here for a long time. And I'm sure we have Dreamers in our state that would like to have something done about this. I was wondering if anything is going to come of it. Thank you.
So Dreamers, children who came here as little ones, they've been in our elementary schools, our high schools, they're working in our businesses, they're working in all kinds of ways, they're going to college, they're contributing. Their legal status was eliminated by President Trump. How many would like to see that legal status restored? Yeah. Well, I can tell you, just last week we had a debate in the Senate. The debate had basic several different versions, but there was a version that was based on work that Lindsey Graham, a Republican, and two other Republicans, and Dick Durbin, a Democrat, and two other Democrats had presented to President Trump. If you turn the clock back about 4 weeks ago, there was a Tuesday gathering at the White House where Trump brought in his the House members, the Senate members, the Democrats, the Republicans. It was kind of a love fest. He kept the press in there for almost an hour, and he said, "I love immigrants," and he said, "You bring me a bipartisan deal, I'll sign it. I'll take the heat," he said, "I'll take the heat." Well, he got a lot of heat the next 2 days. And that president that could take the heat disappeared completely. And he started talking and characterizing all immigrants as MS-13 gang members. And we heard that in the State of the Union. and basically decided to turn this into a continuation of dividing Americans against Americans. And we saw that through the campaign. We saw it through last year. And I think about this every time at a town hall that we have the Pledge of Allegiance. We all stand up, Pledge of Allegiance, United States of America. And we talk about one nation under God, indivisible. Why do we have that word in the pledge, indivisible? It's because we come from every corner of the globe to be part of this great country and build it together to make it even better and not to tear each other down. And yet that is exactly what the president is doing in this situation. And we saw with attacks on veterans, attacks on individuals with disabilities, on women, on Mexican Americans, on Haitian Americans, on African Americans. How about we quit attacking? And whenever the president does do that, let's stand together with those members of our community from that group, arm in arm, side by side, and say, we are all Americans together and we're going to work together to make our community and our nation better. You know, I see the sign here, I dream, you dream, we all dream. The president said that Americans are dreamers. Well, let me just say, dreamers are American. And let's get their status restored. Ah, dreaming is America. Okay. Who's next? Either of those? Yeah. If not, we'll read two more.
I have 2, 5, 7.
Oh, right over here. Right over here. Okay.
Now I forgot what I was going to say.
But it was good, whatever it was.
I wanted to say to the gentleman up here who said he was outraged that he was surprised that Democrats aren't outraged about what's going on with Trump and everything. I'm very surprised that more Republicans aren't outraged about what's going on. Because I can tell you that I was a lifelong Republican, and I'm not anymore. I mean, I'm totally outraged at what's going on in Washington, and I do not support Trump. I did want to ask you one other thing about the, I'm only 65. I wanted to say one thing about, we need to do more about school loans, because I have children who have $40,000, $80,000 in school loans, and they cannot make ends meet, and you can't file bankruptcy on school loans, and they literally can't feed their children, and they have college degrees. So, thank you.
So here's a thought. Let's take a share of that $1.5 trillion that was given away in the tax bill. Let's reclaim it and just do several things. First, I am deeply disturbed that we are not providing public K-12 schools that are as good as the ones our parents provided to us. There were 20 kids in my first grade classroom. There were 34 in my son's. I had, when my kids were small, I'd have 5 or 6 kids in the house. I was like tearing my hair out. How does a teacher do with 34, 5 and 6-year-olds? Any teachers here? Little appreciation for our teachers. So we can do better in K-12. And by the way, I live in a blue-collar community, east side of Portland, and all the extracurricular activities were free when I was a kid. So I didn't have to go to my parents and say, can I get $100 to play basketball? Or I'd like to be on the cross-country team. And now there's fees for everything. And that just precludes so many children from participating. And that's another thing that we could fix. And while we're at it then, let's talk about shop classes need to be restored. And we need CTE, career technical education. There are a lot of pathways to jobs that don't involve college. But for those pathways that do, we should start by enabling everybody with a student loan to refinance it to the same low interest rate the big banks get when they borrow from the federal government. Should help a lot. And then in order to have everyone fully pursue opportunity, there needs to be a path to affordability, to debt-free college, so that people can pursue their dreams and contribute it to the full extent of their abilities. These debts are suffocating the next generation. They can't get loans to buy homes, which is a major form of middle-class wealth. Many people are postponing marriage because they don't feel like they have the financial foundation to get married. We're really, like, the burden is so big. And here's how it reverberates in my neighborhood, because I still live in that blue-collar community. That neighborhood, I hear the parents saying, I'm not sure I should encourage my kids to go to college because they may end up with school loan debt the size of a home mortgage and no job. And then they'll be burdened forever. How do you work your way out from that? And when kids hear that, they change their aspirations. Now, I was lucky. My dad, a mechanic, said, hey, son, you go through the doors of that schoolhouse and you work hard and you can do just about anything because we live here in America. Didn't matter which side of the railroad tracks you came from. And I loved that. I was like, wow, that's so cool. Here in America, the opportunity for everyone. And we have lost that vision, and we need to restore it. Thank you. And did we have one more?
216.
Right up here.
Being here again, Senator, really appreciate it, given the fact that there are a lot of representatives that don't think that they have maybe the moxie or something to face their constituents with what's going on. So I really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you for being so nice to me while I'm here.
Yes.
2009, 2010, although it was a little different.
Exactly. So. Takes a little moxie to even be a senator, so you understand that. I have a concern that maybe isn't talked about as much, but I know there's been talk from the opposition side, the Republican Party, in trying to make the concealed carry provision in some states, make that like a full faith and credit we have with driver's licenses. So if you have a concealed weapon permit in, say, Pennsylvania, you can just travel out to Los Angeles and you're good to go with your concealed permit without any ability of the state where you land being able to certify. That, to me, really put icicles in my heart thinking about that if law enforcement doesn't have enough problems. And it also supersedes what the local and state laws think is good for their thing. I haven't heard any rebuttal or any opposition against that from the Democrats or even Republicans in states, you know, from where they have large populations. Could you please tell me what Congress is doing about this and if I need to be a little less afraid or not?
So this proposal has been to override states' ability to control the rules on how they pass out concealed weapon. And there's a series of other efforts to override state rules. And everything I hear from law enforcement is that we want to keep that power. And I think what I've heard from Oregonians, no great desire to have Texas determining how those rules work here or any other state for that matter. Let Oregon cover that. And I think we'll see okay about it. Was that are we out of time?
Is there time for another one? Very quickly. 259.
To follow up on what was asked about the Dreamers, is there anything the Senate can do to rein in ICE and what I feel like is a war of fear against our immigrant community?
So we have asked, so Senator Wyden and I have lobbied, if you will, the executive branch to respect safe zones around our schools, around our courthouses, and we've challenged them on some of the detentions, like they went inside a house without permission to detain a painter who was actually an American citizen because he looked Hispanic and things of that nature. And so I think we have to be vocal about that. And but its enforcement is really in the province of the executive branch. There's a frustration that the man who wrote The Art of the Deal and when there was a bipartisan bill before him on both border security and on Dreamers, couldn't close that, chose not to be able to close that deal, chose not to even try, in fact, to blow it up. With ICE, I just, we'll keep pushing, but it's under the president's control. So, and that's not a very satisfactory answer, I know. I just want to close by thanking you all for coming out here during a weekday to fill this hall and to discuss these issues before us. Most congressional House and Senate members don't hold town halls because of the vitriol. Our parties are further apart than they've ever been. The news media reinforces that because there's news media on the left and there's news media on the right. And one way we get out of those camps is to come have a common public discussion. And we need more of that community and connection here in our country. So meanwhile, we need to have Russia really have its leash jerked really hard. Russia... Really interesting reading. Read the indictment about the 13 Russians. It lays out a vision of what they did. Let me give you an example. There was a demonstration during the presidential campaign where there was a cage with a person dressed up like Hillary Clinton, and it's basically and then chance of lock her up. It turns out the Russians set up that demonstration. They coordinated that demonstration. There were a bunch of the themes that tried to divide along Black Lives Matter and a host of other things were hashtags either invented by groups of Russians or accentuated to divide us. And we have got to recognize that what they did to undermine our election is a strategy of a non-democratic republic trying to destroy Western democracy. And we need a watchdog in Congress and in the most importantly the presidency to say absolutely not, we're not going to let another country come in here and mess with our elections or divide our country. And that includes having the president put in place the sanctions that Congress on a bipartisan basis passed like 500-5. Like, when do you ever get anything passed by Congress 500-5? Those sanctions the president has not implemented. He announced a couple weeks he's not going to. Well, let's demand he implement them. Let's let Russia know this type of meddling will never be tolerated here in the land of the home and the land of the free. And thank you so much for coming out today and being part of this discussion. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special public affairs program recorded and produced by Coast Community Radio. This town hall meeting with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley was recorded live at the Bob Chisholm Community Center in Seaside, Oregon on February 20th, 2018.